Before long, we'll be where it would have taken mankind millions of years of learning to reach.
And what will Mitchell learn on getting there? Will he know what to do with his power?
That's the big agenda here, is undermining the whole idea of journalism, and that's the real thing to worry about.
The good old Ministry of Truth has another outlet.
Too often, broadcast radio insults your intelligence instead of respecting it, improving it, challenging it. But not here. Where knowledge is power, this is Powerful Radio. This is 30 minutes of information and inspiration. This is the Ministry of Truth. Hello and welcome to the Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Szczepańczyk. On today's show, we'll feature an interview with Ryszard Bester, a Polish Chicago construction worker who is fighting to recover more than $70,000 of lost wages against a former employer. We'll also hear a commentary from the website Black Agenda Report. But now, we'll hear two segments from the weekly program of Media and Democracy entitled Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
This week, a crowd of 150 leaders in journalism, philanthropy, and business gathered in St. Paul, Minnesota to address the crisis of declining local and regional journalism. The Future of News Summit, hosted by American Public Media and Minnesota Public Radio, tackled complex questions facing the worlds of commercial and public media alike. Andrew Haig is Public Insight Editor at American Public Media. He says that the summit came together quickly out of the necessity to address major questions about how to sustain a future for journalism on the local level.
Content has been atomized, and the unit of content is no longer the publication. It's the story, or it's the piece of journalism. How do you adjust to an environment where the ability to aggregate a mass audience and to, quote-unquote, monetize that through advertising is no longer really possible? Are we attempting to preserve the structures of the institutions that have traditionally produced this kind of journalism? Or are we trying to preserve the values of journalism that have informed how we produce socially valuable journalism and public service journalism? And I think the consensus in the room was that, yes, I mean, of course, we're trying to preserve the values of journalism.
Those values were laid out by Tom Rosentiel, director of the Project for Excellence in Journalism, as being that journalists provide facts, make sense of what's happening, stand as watchdog, show up and bear witness, serve as a forum leader to engage community, aggregate and distill information, empower their audiences, and provide a role model for citizen journalists. There was also a lot of discussion over whether there should be an increased role for federally subsidized public service journalism. But attendees disagreed over whether journalism should be considered a public or private good.
And I think that's a really, to me, an interesting tension that's going to play out over the next several months and years. And it's trying to figure out where are the gaps in journalism, where has the market failed, and therefore where the nonprofits and the federal government need to step in. And I don't think that's at all clear right now.
The day's discussions were distilled into an instant white paper, co-authored by Haig, which laid out the major findings and lingering questions to come out of the summit. To read the white paper, visit thefutureofnews.ning.com.
The Federal Communications Commission is working on a national broadband plan, and the need for more broadband for our phones, netbooks, and laptops is driving the agency to find new sources of spectrum. And they floated an interesting prospect. Should we use local TV airwaves for wireless broadband? The airwaves belong to the public. They're only licensed to broadcasters. But, as Harold Feld of Public Knowledge explains, many broadcasters don't regard the airwaves as public property.
The broadcasters have had this allocation in this system really since the 1930s and the 1940s. This creates an unfortunately very anachronistic way about thinking about broadcast spectrum, both in terms of what you do with it. You're doing a single thing with it, just sending one type of information in one direction, and also in terms of the mentality. Despite the fact that the law says very clearly that spectrum is the public airwaves, that it is a public asset, that there's no ownership of broadcast licenses, after 70 years, broadcasters think of this as their spectrum.
It's the FCC's job to ensure efficient, fair, and equitable use of the airwaves. And with only a small percentage of the population now receiving over-the-air broadcast TV since the transition to digital signals, the FCC is questioning whether to continue to broadcast local TV in the same way it's always done, and is considering other ways to ensure free TV reception to those who need it. One idea is to auction unused portions of the airwaves off to the highest bidder. But Feld says that is not a solution for the 21st century because it wouldn't bring more competition to the wireless industry, since only the big companies can afford to bid at spectrum auctions. And there's another reason.
What it does is reinforce the old ways of thinking about wireless access, and both that it's a scarce resource that we ought to be paying for instead of treating it as something that we could conserve and move to reuse and not treat as a limited resource, and it reinforces the ownership idea.
Feld wants to move away from the old model of broadcasters and wireless service providers monopolizing our airwaves. He's advocating for changing broadcast policy to make better use of the airwaves, using new technology in the so-called white spaces between the TV channels. He also wants to open up the spectrum to more services.
If we think of wireless as potentially our public square, would we want to lease out our public square because we could make more money that way? Or is it something that we want to figure out how to let everybody get a fair shake at having a chance to use?
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net. Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
As the Federal Communications Commission prepares a national broadband plan, Native Americans want to be part of the discussions. Tribal lands have been largely ignored by federal policymakers. A new study, New Media, Technology, and Internet Use in Indian Country, surveyed more than 120 tribes living in 28 states about how the Internet is being used for blogging, political research, driving directions, uploading photos and video, and text messaging. The results showed that Native Americans are using the Internet at higher rates than their counterparts in the rest of the country. But Tracy Morris of Native Public Media, who co-authored the report, points out that while Indians are using the Internet at higher rates, it doesn't mean they have easy access on Indian lands.
It does mean that the people are resourceful and they're finding ways to gain access, whether they're driving to hotspots, they're driving a long distance to hotspots, or whatever they're doing, they are reaching out and seeking access to the Internet in that way.
Loris Ann Taylor, executive director of Native Public Media, says that the six successful digital projects surveyed in the study are community-centric.
You have tribes here who are investing their own money into deploying broadband because in many circumstances they don't qualify for the federal funds that are supposed to help deploy broadband out into rural and remote communities.
The tribes made sure that the major institutions like tribal government, schools, law enforcement, health centers, and radio stations were connected first. These projects, ranging from providing internet service to building computers for the tribal members to creating digital communities, can serve as a model for other tribes as well as non-tribal communities. The study recommends the creation of a tribal broadband plan within the national broadband plan. It says tribal entities should help with planning and mapping. A national FCC Native Nations Broadband Task Force and a tribal office at the FCC are also recommended.
If you have 564 Native Nations in this country who are federally recognized, then more tribes that are going through the recognition process, then there's a real need for the FCC to have an office to make sure that there's some consultation going on with these nations.
To read the report, go to nativepublicmedia.org.
The debate over network neutrality, the fundamental principle that keeps internet service providers from discriminating against lawful websites, content, or applications, has moved from the halls of Washington to city council agendas in New York and San Francisco. Last week, the New York City Council held a hearing on a resolution to back strong net neutrality protections to, quote, ensure that the internet will continue to foster innovation, increase competition, and spur economic growth, as well as making the internet faster and more affordable for all. Testifying at the meeting were several public interest advocates who discussed the significance of the city's resolution. Art Brodsky, Communications Director of Public Knowledge, was among them.
It's important to all the internet users, it's important to all the internet developers to have an open, vibrant, and non-discriminatory internet. And to the extent that you can influence the Congress of the United States through your voice up here in this committee and the council as a whole, you'll make a very good contribution to preserving that open environment, which is so important.
Also testifying was Tim Carr, Campaign Director of Free Press. He presented the council with over 4,000 signatures from concerned New Yorkers who support net neutrality.
Much is at stake for the tens of millions of Americans who rely upon the internet every day. Despite the debate, I don't believe anyone on this panel or in this room would dispute two notions. First, over the past 40 years, the internet has emerged as an unprecedented tool for spreading innovative ideas, increasing public participation in our democracy, fostering economic opportunity, even in the most overlooked communities. Second, I don't believe we would disagree that we need sound public policies to encourage faster, more open, and affordable internet access for everyone in the country. We need to pass the right policies right now.
Brodsky warned the council not to get distracted.
You'll hear a lot of things about the threats to the economy from net neutrality. You hear a lot of probably some engineering mumbo jumbo about how you can't have a non-discriminatory internet. All net neutrality means is you can't play favorites.
San Francisco is considering a similar resolution in support of net neutrality. Both city councils are expected to vote on the resolutions in the coming weeks. To learn more about net neutrality, visit savetheinternet.com.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
And now, a commentary from the website Black Agenda Report.
If you're looking for the chief kingpin in the Afghanistan heroin trade, it's the United States. The American mission has devolved to a mafiosa-style arrangement that poisons every military and political alliance entered into by the U.S. and its puppet government in Kabul. It is a gangster occupation in which U.S.-allied drug dealers are put in charge of the police and the border patrol, while their rivals are placed on American hit lists marked for death or capture. As a result, Afghanistan has been transformed into an opium plantation that supplies 90% of the world's heroin. An article in the current issue of Harper's Magazine explores the inner workings of the drug-infested U.S. occupation, its near-total dependence on alliances forged with players in the heroin trade. The story centers on the town of Spin Baldak on the southeastern border with Pakistan, gateway to the opium fields of Kandahar and Helmand provinces. The chief Afghan drug lord is also the head of the border patrol and the local militia. The author is an undercover U.S.-based journalist who was befriended by the drug lord's top operatives and met with the U.S. and Canadian officers that collaborate with the drug dealer on a daily basis. The alliance was forged by the American forces during the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan in 2001 and has endured and grown ever since. The drug lord, and others like him throughout the country, is not only immune to serious American interference, he has been empowered through U.S. money and arms to consolidate his drug business at the expense of drug-dealing rivals in other tribes, forcing some of them into alliance with the Taliban. On the ground in Pashtun-speaking Afghanistan, the war is largely between armies run by heroin merchants, some aligned with the Americans, others with the Taliban. The Taliban appear to be gaining the upper hand in this mafiosa gang war, the origins of which are directly rooted in U.S. policy. Is it any wonder, then, that the United States so often launches airstrikes against civilian wedding parties, wiping out the greater part of bride and groom's extended families? America's drug-dealing allies have been dropping dimes on rival clans and tribes, using the Americans as high-tech muscle in their deadly feuds. Now the Americans and their European occupation partners have institutionalized the rules of gangster warfare, with official hit lists of drug dealers to be killed or captured on sight, lists drawn up by other drug lords affiliated with the occupation forces. This is the war of necessity that President Barack Obama has embraced as his own. It is a war whose order of battle is largely defined by the drug trade. Obama's generals call for tens of thousands of new U.S. troops in hopes of lessening their dependency on the militias and police forces currently controlled by American-allied drug dealers. But of course, that will only push America's Afghan partners in the drug trade into the arms of the Taliban, who will cut a better deal. Then the generals will argue that they need even more U.S. troops. The Americans created this drug-saturated hell, and their occupation is now doomed by it. Unfortunately, they have also doomed millions of Afghans in the process. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to www.blackagendareport.com.
You're listening to The Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Strapinczyk. We now feature an interview with Richard Bester, a Polish Chicago construction worker who is fighting to recover more than $70,000 of lost wages against a former employer. Mr. Bester has worked with Arise Chicago Worker Center, which has partnered with workers to recover $3.8 million in stolen wages and has called for a stricter punishment and consequences for the employers who do not respect their workers' rights. With the help of the Worker Center, three Polish construction workers, Richard Bester, along with Dariusz Jaworski and Bogusław Moskal, are campaigning to recover over $70,000 of stolen wages for work they performed for Mr. Walter Bochanek, the honorary president of the Polish American Builders Association and the owner of Master Hand Contractors, Master House Builders, and Percon LTD. The following is an interview with Richard Bester and with Anna Karevich of Arise Chicago, who provided translation assistance, recorded on November 24th, 2009. We are joined on the phone, mam na telefon, Richard Bester. He is a worker who is working with the Arise Worker Center, Arise Chicago Worker Center, to recover stolen wages. We are also joined on the phone by Anka Karevich, who is a Polish organizer with Arise Chicago. They are both joining us on the phone in a conference call from Chicago. And witamy serdecznie. Welcome to the show. We will have Anka translate the...
Dzień dobry.
We will have Anka translate the questions. Anka będzie tłumacz pytanie, że pytać. Let me begin by asking Mr. Bester. Can you tell us briefly what happened with why you're fighting for lost wages?
So my name is Richard Bester, and I'm a former employee of Mr. Bochanek, and I was working for Mr. Bochanek, and over the last year, Mr. Bochanek had a good contract. Mr. Bochanek got a contract on a Catholic school. And he gathered all his employees and told them that right now we're starting an honest work, referring to before he wasn't paying on a regular basis. I mean, there was always some money that was owed back. He wasn't paying regularly. At the beginning, we were happy with what Mr. Bochanek had told us. And at the beginning, the payments were regular for about 4 months, but then the problems with payments started. When the payments started being irregular, we started asking Mr. Bochanek for money. And he would always say, oh, I'll pay you next Tuesday, I'll pay you next Friday. He didn't stop paying completely. He started paying minimally. Sometimes it was twice a month. There was $1,000 here, $500 there, or $800. So he would still pay, but there was his debt was growing bigger and bigger. So when these payments were so small, we didn't have money to leave. We had to. We started living on debt. So in that way, all workers started taking credit card debt or just borrowing money from friends, including me. I didn't have money to leave, so I used all my savings, and also I started living on credit card debt. So at some point, the workers, we got together and we officially went to Mr. Bochanek. That was, we asked for money before, but this was like more of taking an official stand and requesting that Mr. Bochanek pays us money. So we all decided to go on strike until stop working until Mr. Bohanna gives us a check that would enable us to survive, to support ourselves. When we did that, Bohanna started promising that, yeah, I'll pay next Monday. But then when we said we can take it, he fired us.
Did Mr. Bohanek explain why he couldn't pay what you were owed?
Okay, so it's hard for me to understand it, because according to my information that I had obtained from a person who worked for the school, Mr. Bohanek was paid everything that he was owed by the school. So all the contract, according to what was told me from the side of the school, was paid to Mr. Bohanek.
How has the community, Polish-speaking and in Chicago, reacted to your strike? Have they been supportive?
So when we went on start on strike, it was more of an inside action. The only people who knew about it were our relatives, our friends, but we wouldn't go public with it. So our friends, our close friends, were supportive, but we didn't spread the message out to the community yet.
That has now changed. In fact, just last week there was a press conference, so you've now made it public. And I because the Mr. Bohanek has refused to pay, is that correct?
Okay, so yes, how it started was I listened on the radio about Arise Chicago, about the organization and Mr. Evich, and then the three of us, three workers who were in paid, we came to Mr. Evich and we in search of help. With help of Arise Chicago and Mr. Evich, we were able to get the message out to go more public, not only among Polish community, but also get the message across in the English media about what happened to us, for which we are very grateful that we were able to do it.
Has all of this action changed Mr. Bohanek's mind at all? Is he still not paid yet?
So before that action, we were still trying to give Mr. Bohanek one more chance and resolve the case without going public, but there was no response from the other side. And Mr. Bohanek never picked up the phone. So to answer your question, we have not had any contact with Mr. Bohanek, and there was no response, and we're not sure where he is currently staying and what his reaction to the actions is.
In the meantime, you haven't received due payment, but you still need money. So my question is, how are you surviving in the meantime? Do you have another job, or what are you doing?
After a month or 2 months and a half, I can't remember exactly, of not working, I was lucky to get another job, and I am currently working, but one of the workers was working with me, he is still unemployed. Since I'm working, I'm slowly getting out of that, but it is still hard.
What would you say to others who may want to support your cause? What you think? What kind of support are you looking for from others who may be interested in helping you?
So from my side, it's really hard to ask for support, but my message to other people in similar situations would be just be brave and don't be afraid. People should stand up for their rights and try to get their rights back. and they should occupy themselves in the active process of claiming what their rights are, and at the same time warning others so nothing like this will happen to other people, to other workers.
We have been speaking with Richard Bester and with Anna Karevich. Anna is an organizer with the Arise Chicago Worker Center, working on behalf of the rights of workers who are struggling for their rights, as well as with Richard Bester, who is a worker working to recover stolen wages by Mr. Walter Bochenek. Pani Karevich, Richard, dziękuję bardzo na wszystko.
Dziękuję bardzo.
That was Polish construction worker Richard Bester with Anna Karevich of Arise Chicago. If you want to learn more, go online to www.arisechicago.org or call 773-769-6000. Again, 773-769-6000. Jeśli chciałbym zapytać, proszę idzie strona internetowa www.arisechicago.org albo dzwoni 773-769-6000. Jeszcze raz, 773-769-6000. Listen to all past episodes of the Ministry of Truth online at www.szcz.org. That concludes this episode of the Ministry of Truth. Special thanks to Mario and the staff of WHPK Radio in Chicago. Thank you for listening.